From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, 4 hours warning claims surface Nigeria's military failed to act despite being told of an imminent raid on the school where scores of girls still missing were abducted.
Nigerian authorities had information at 7 o'clock on the evening that those girls were taken from their school, 4 hours before the attack on the school took place, and they did not respond to that.
Also today, as the bloodshed in Ukraine continues, Vladimir Putin makes a controversial visit to Crimea. And why Brazil's poor Olympic preparations could see the 2016 Games return to London.
At this stage in the run-up to 2012, London was about 60% ready for the Games. Rio, it's said, is around 10% there.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Russian President Vladimir Putin has traveled to Crimea for the first time since it was annexed from Ukraine by Russian forces in March. He was there to mark the 69th anniversary of the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany, but his visit has drawn angry reaction from Kiev. Officials there called it a gross violation of Ukraine's sovereignty. Ukrainian authorities also said more than 20 people have died in clashes between security forces and pro-Moscow militants in Mariupol. The news comes as the European Union prepares to add more names to its list of Russian officials for sanctioning over the Ukraine crisis. Currently, 48 individuals are under asset freezes and asset bans, but the next additions are likely to include companies as well. Here's our EU reporter, Jack Perak.
A referendum being held in Donetsk on whether the region should become independent from Ukraine will go ahead on Sunday, but the result will not be observed by the West, who support the new government in Kiev. The new names on the EU blacklist will come out Monday at the Foreign Affairs Council meeting in Brussels. Who will be on it will be affected by the weekend's events. It remains in stage two of the sanctions programme, though, and there are some in the European Union who are eager to move into the third phase of broader sanctions targeting whole sectors of the Russian economy.
UK-based rights group Amnesty International says Nigeria's security forces had warnings that Islamist insurgent group Boko Haram was planning an attack on the school where more than 240 girls were abducted. The damning findings said the security forces had more than 4 hours of warning that the raid would take place, but did not do what was needed to stop it. Here's our UK correspondent Natalie Fury.
Amnesty International says its findings were based on several interviews and were independently confirmed. Netsenet Bele, Africa Director for the rights charity, said it amounted to a gross dereliction of Nigeria's duty to protect civilians. Amnesty's findings said that troops were not sent to the school in Chibok due to an inability to gather them because of a lack of resources and a fear of confronting members of Boko Haram, who are often better equipped. More than 3 weeks since the abduction, more than 200 girls remain captive and their whereabouts are unknown.
Meanwhile, both US and UK teams have arrived in Nigeria to begin helping the government in the search for the girls. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan says the help coming from the international community should mark a turning point in the fight against Boko Haram. London's Metropolitan Police Service have arrested a 38-year-old woman at Heathrow Airport for conspiring to commit female genital mutilation. It comes after a week-long initiative at the airport aimed at preventing and detecting the crime as part of Operation Limelight. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. With the U.S. Congress unable to reach an agreement this week on key energy legislation, President Obama is sidestepping them with more executive orders he says will address the growing threat of climate change. Alice Olstein has more from Washington.
Speaking in California on Friday, President Obama laid out plans to invest an additional $2 billion in making buildings across the U.S. more energy efficient, and additional funding to support an expansion of solar energy production in the public and private sectors. He said such steps will both help the planet and companies' bottom lines.
People say we can't afford to do it. Won't be good for the economy. It will be good for the economy long term, and if we don't, that will be bad for the economy.
The announcement comes just days after the release of a federal report documenting the impacts of climate change happening right now across the United States.
And a UK court has heard the outline of the prosecution's case against children's entertainer Rolf Harris. He's accused of 12 charges of indecent assault on four girls between 1968 and 1986. Mr. Harris denies all charges against him, as our UK correspondent Natalie Powell reports.
According to the prosecution, Rolf Harris's alleged victims were aged between 7 or 8 and 19 when it's claimed the offences took place. Seven of the 12 charges are said to relate to one victim who was a friend of the accused's daughter from the age of 13 onwards. The prosecution argued that Mr. Harris was a Jekyll and Hyde character. He denies the charges, entering a not guilty plea in January, and was supported in court by his daughter Bindi and his wife. Natalie Powell, London.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Nigeria's military knew the attack on a school where nearly 300 girls were abducted last month was imminent, but failed to act. That's the claim of Amnesty International, who said the Nigerian security forces had 4 hours' warning that a Boko Haram convoy was en route to the area. While 58 of the girls escaped, over 200 are still being held by the Islamist group. The authorities have not yet commented on Amnesty's statement. Teams of experts from the US and the UK have arrived in Nigeria to help locate and rescue the girls. Kate Allen, director of Amnesty International UK, spoke to Ian Dale of Britain's LBC Radio. He asked her about the allegations over the Nigerian authorities' response.
Well, our information comes from multiple interviews with many credible sources, and we have verified those. We also have had conversations with very senior military officers that we've worked with before, and we are absolutely solid in what we are saying today, which is that the Nigerian authorities had information at 7 o'clock on the evening that those girls were taken from their school, and that's 4 hours before the attack on the school took place, and they did not respond to that. They were asked for reinforcements at 7 o'clock in the evening. Nobody came. And even by the time the attack had finished in the early hours of the next day at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, still no reinforcements had come. So we are making this very clear today that there was no political will, no urgency on the part of the Nigerian authorities to protect those girls and to protect people in that area of the country.
Well, if all that's true, it's absolutely horrifying. But of course, we are where we are. What do you think can be done now? Do you think the Nigerian government is taking it seriously enough now?
I don't think anybody thinks that the Nigerian government is taking it seriously enough, and certainly the parents of those girls don't think that. I am pleased that help is on its way to the Nigerian authorities to see what can be done to locate the girls. And, you know, all effort must go into that. But the Nigerian authorities must learn the lessons. They cannot neglect their civilians and their children in this way. We have documented over 2,000 deaths in that part of Nigeria in this year alone. And, you know, civilians and girls' schools should not be left unprotected in this way.
What can everybody do? I mean, we just heard about the demonstration outside the Nigerian embassy. Obviously, this story is very big on social media, but in a sense, everyone feels very powerless. It is only concerted international action, which the Nigerians need to welcome and accept. It's only that that can actually maybe bring about a result here.
Oh, but this is how change happens, isn't it? It's the power of ordinary people. And so seeing what is happening in Trafalgar Square and seeing that replicated across the world, this is a story that has touched so many people. That, you know, ordinary people standing up about this is what is essential. It will give solidarity to those parents who will know that they are not alone in the demands that they are making and the horrors of what they are going through as parents.
Kate Allen with Amnesty International UK. A.O. Johnson is a journalist specialising in African affairs, and he told Nick Ferrari of LBC Radio that Boko Haram is trying to grab global attention.
It just shows the group is very desperate. It wants publicity. It feeds off that publicity. And, of course, it's trying to do as worse as it possibly can by capturing more girls, or at times even attacking and killing people in large numbers. This is not the first time it's done so, and repeatedly so. It will continue, as it's shown previously, if it's not stopped. And, of course, security forces around the world, including the United States and hopefully Britain, sending troops or special forces to help the Nigerian government as a step in the right direction.
It's worth noting that Nigeria is Africa's richest country. There are also suggestions that the government really has looked the other way, not done anything, has steadfastly failed to tackle this for a number of years, and that is why the problem is so intense now. How fair is that assessment?
Well, I think the Nigerian government has the responsibility, which they've shown previously to do, but unlikely to be able to stop this group. The entire Goodluck Jonathan administration in government has been surrounded by this problem, and to that extent, Goodluck Jonathan is responsible for what has happened, especially with a group not being contained and ultimately their ability to appear, disappear at will. I think it's a failure of intelligence, it's a failure of the security force to protect the people, and ultimately Boko Haram and its wider cell, which includes Al-Qaeda, we must say, have become stronger over the last few months.
And just lastly, presumably at the moment, Boko Haram's plan is to try and effectively bring about a sense of anarchy in the part of Nigeria in which they operate. So the government and the security forces are despised, and effectively they can take control.
Yes, Boko Haram is very focused on what he wants to achieve, which is very much a Sharia state, a Sharia law, a Muslim country ultimately in Nigeria, which is unlikely to happen. And of course, you can tell by its aggressive nature by which it's operated over the last few months, and it's becoming somewhat daring and its ability to do what it's doing. Firstly, I think Boko Haram is not going to stop, not unless its leader is captured, and ultimately if the cell is dismantled, that in itself will not happen unless Nigeria opens up, asks for help, receives that help, and ultimately the intelligence services start to make an inroad into this group.
A.O. Johnson, a journalist specialising in African affairs. This is FSN Reports. Inappropriate. That's how NATO's chief described President Vladimir Putin's first public appearance in Crimea since the peninsula was absorbed by Russia. His controversial appearance came as Ukraine suffered one of the bloodiest days since the crisis began. As many as 21 were killed in the southeastern port of Mariupol as clashes raged between pro-Russian gunmen and Ukrainian security forces. Despite an earlier call from Mr. Putin to postpone a referendum on independence in eastern Ukraine, that vote is likely to go ahead on Sunday. For the latest developments, I spoke to journalist Gulliver Cragg in the Ukrainian capital.
Well, it's clearly something that the Ukrainian authorities find very provocative, considering that they have not accepted Russia's annexation of Crimea, and nor for that matter has much of the rest of the world. So it's in a way in contrast for Vladimir Putin to make this provocative gesture just after he had been making sort of reconciliatory noises by saying that Ukraine's presidential election actually should go ahead, was a step in the right direction, and encouraging separatists in the east of the country not to hold the referendums that they're planning for Sunday on independence for two eastern Ukrainian regions. But the separatists have said that those referendums are going to go ahead anyway, and some people are speculating that Putin only called for the referendums to be postponed in order to give the world the impression that he doesn't actually control the separatists. As you know, these separatists in eastern Ukraine are widely suspected of being directed from Moscow.
And as Vladimir Putin marked that victory day, what Russians call victory day in Crimea, there was more bloody clashes in eastern Ukraine. What can you tell us about that?
The bloody clashes took place in the port city of Mariupol in Donetsk region, south of Donetsk. According to the Ukrainian Interior Ministry, what happened is that separatists tried to take the police headquarters there, as they have actually done several times in the past few days and been forced back. There's been a lot of unrest in Mariupol recently, but today it turned really, really bloody with, according to the Ukrainian Interior Ministry, again, 20 people dead on the pro-Russian side, though some local media are saying the figure is less than that, and at least one dead among the Ukrainian armed forces. There was a gun battle there that lasted for 2 hours, followed by a fire in the police station. So things turned really bloody there in Mariupol, though actually everyone in Ukraine was expecting that there might be provocations and fights in the regional capitals around Ukraine, or even in Kyiv. There was a very tense atmosphere in Kyiv this morning at those Victory Day commemorations, but all the other cities, so far anyway, stayed calm. But in Mariupol, very bloody day indeed.
Gulliver Cragg in Ukraine. The worst ever seen. The damning assessment of International Olympic Committee Vice President John Coates on Brazil's preparations for the 2016 Games. However, there could be a plan B, because London has reportedly been asked if it could take over the 2016 Olympics from Brazil. London's Evening Standard newspaper says an informal approach has been made to the British capital, which successfully staged the 2012 Games. UK correspondent Ollie Barrett spoke to me earlier.
Well, front page of London's Friday Evening Standard claims that Olympic bosses are so concerned about the state of Brazil's preparations for Rio 2016 that London has been secretly approached about taking over. The paper says the fact that London hosted in 2012, to almost universal praise really, makes it a good potential fallback. And that obviously London has newly built Olympic venues that could be reused rather than needing to be built from scratch.
And do you think, Ollie, that London would actually take this on?
The paper says it's been told by an official that the city would certainly be up for it. But this quoted official is anonymous. Londoners did, by and large, I think it's fair to say, love hosting the 2012 Games. There was a remarkable atmosphere here at the time, helped certainly by a huge haul of medals for Team GB. And so this story has got people talking in a positive way about the idea, but it wouldn't be easy. Many of London's venues, just by way of example, were actually temporary and have now gone. The athletes' village is now apartments. So this would still be a huge task and would obviously be expensive again. And even with the euphoria of 2012 here in London, critics did still question whether actually, when you boil it down, it was worth the money.
OK, so is this a realistic prospect or just a bit of journalistic license being taken here?
Well, the International Olympic Committee's Vice President John Coates recently called Brazil's readiness the worst I've experienced. At this stage in the run-up to 2012, London was about 60% ready for the Games. Rio, it said, is around 10% there. So clearly the IOC is going to be worried, and it will have to look at ways of making sure that 2016 can happen. But the Evening Standard does admit right at the end of its article that an IOC spokesperson says the idea of moving the Rio Games to London is a non-starter and unfeasible. But the idea is now out there.
FSN's Ollie Barrett in London. Now, civilians in Syria have returned to the old city of Homs after the last opposition fighters were evacuated. Government forces have moved back in 2 years after they were forced out by the rebels. But it's an island of calm in the otherwise bitter conflict, and it comes as the United Nations says Syria's remaining chemical weapons are inaccessible due to fighting in the country. FSN's Nick Harper reports from the UN headquarters in New York.
Hundreds of civilians stream back into the old city of Homs. Some wave, others show victory signs. Many are smiling. With the opposition fighters gone, the city is peaceful. But while it's physically easy to return to the city, emotionally, this is a painful journey. The old city of Homs is scarred and battered from 3 years of fighting. Almost reduced to ruins, little remains of the once magnificent 2,000-year-old city. And for many of those who've come back, there's little of their former lives. Piles of rubble occupy the spaces where their homes once stood.
I could not enter my home through the door. I entered through a hole in the wall. Everything surrounding the house is damaged. The house has only columns.
Under a 3-day ceasefire, the United Nations has ushered out the remaining rebel fighters. The opposition held this area, which became known as the capital of the revolution, for nearly 2 years. The governor of Homs proudly announces the city is empty of guns and fighters. But elsewhere, the fighting rages on. On Thursday, opposition fighters blew up the Carlton Citadel Hotel in Aleppo, where government forces were reportedly based. More than a dozen were killed in the blast. And amid the conflict, the mission to remove Syria's chemical weapons continues. The United Nations' Sigrid Karg, who heads up the operation, says so far 92% of the weapons have been removed.
Significant milestones have been met, but we do need that final push to achieve 100% and to complete the work as foreseen in the entire chemical weapons elimination program.
But now another delay. After several missed deadlines for the ongoing removal and destruction of the stockpile, the UN says the final chemicals are at sites in a rebel-held area and can't be reached.
The remaining 8% is currently inaccessible due to the security conditions in country. We're only talking about 16 containers, 5 priority 1, 11 priority 2 chemical weapons material.
But Karg says the remaining weapons could be removed very quickly, in less than a week, once access is given. But while the chemicals remain inaccessible, the final deadline for the complete removal and destruction of Syria's stockpile is in doubt. June 30th is fast approaching. But even while that mission is winding up, more investigations are needed. A new team has arrived in Damascus, ready to investigate claims the Syrian government, in 3 separate attacks, used chlorine gas, a chemical that was never part of the original stockpile disarmament agreement. Nick Harper, New York.
Finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, our new segment, taking an in-depth look at a story you may have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, Ali Baba, not the age-old folktale from the Arabian Nights, but the Chinese e-commerce giant that is about to go IPO on Wall Street. Just how big is it? Last year, Alibaba sold $248 billion worth of goods. In one day alone, $5.8 billion worth of transactions passed through its coffers. Think of it as China's answer to Amazon, PayPal, and eBay, all rolled into one. Not bad for a company that began in 1999 in the living room of Chinese entrepreneur Jack Ma.
My 8 companies, I would say nobody help us. Only we can help ourselves.
Today, he's a popular figure at business conferences around the world where he extols the virtues of going it alone and excoriates the world's banks for failing to provide sufficient support to small and medium-sized enterprises.
Don't rely on the government. Don't rely on the banks. Forget about that. Rely on friends. Rely on relatives. Rely on the small dreams. And always keep that thing in mind, because I've been trying very hard to get loans from banks. Always trouble.
Jack Ma owns just under 9% of the enterprise he founded. America's Yahoo owns 22% and, like Mr. Ma, is expected to benefit greatly from the company's IPO. Financial analysts say it could generate as much as $245 billion when shares finally go on sale. Tim Cross is science and technology correspondent for The Economist, and he told the paper's innovation editor, Paul Markilly, that Alibaba still has huge potential for expansion.
So Alibaba is a Chinese internet firm, and it's not any old Chinese internet firm. It's the sort of dominant player in China's online retail market. It's sort of a mix in Western terms of Amazon, eBay, PayPal. There are actually sort of 25 individual little sort of business divisions. It's a really sort of vast conglomerate. And to give some idea of its scale, the amount of goods that it handled last year was greater than the amount handled by eBay and Amazon put together. So it's the biggest company in what will soon be, if it isn't already, the world's biggest e-commerce market.
So this is something of a monster then. Is there a lot of interest in it, I guess?
There's a huge amount of interest. So the IPO is going in New York. The figures go up to about $200 billion, which would make it, you know, comfortably the biggest IPO for a very, very long time.
So how easy is it to value a company like this?
There are reasons to think that it might do rather well. I mean, as I said, you know, internet penetration in China is only about sort of, it's around 40-50%, about half of people have access to this. So there's plenty more room for growth. The company's grown sort of spectacularly in recent years, and it's so big now, it's so dominant that it doesn't need to rely on search engines for its customers, which means a lot of people are advertised directly with it. It runs an online marketplace like eBay. It lets other companies, you know, in which other companies can set up storefronts. It runs a payment service, a bit like PayPal, which is the most popular such service in China. You know, it's become so big that anything it moves into, it can sort of quite easily dominate. So you could could build a case that, yes, you know, the only way for this firm is up. On the other hand, you know, it's suffering from sort of too big syndrome, or some people think it might be, whereby sort of other sort of smaller, more nimble competitors are sort of starting to chip away at individual parts of its business. And of course, it's very, very hard to predict the value of a company like this. You know, its valuation is dependent on what China's economy does, which is a big sort of open question as to how long, you know, this kind of spectacular growth rate can keep going. It's dependent on whether you think there is a sort of bit of froth or a full-blown bubble in tech stocks generally. It's very hard to know, but there are certainly reasons to be optimistic, I'd say.
Tim Cross of The Economist. But what of Western investors? Should they be worried about the Chinese government's control of the internet, the space in which Alibaba primarily operates? Paul Sweeney of Bloomberg News spoke to Judy Woodruff about that on the PBS NewsHour.
Most of the investors, when they think about the Chinese e-commerce business, you know, I think they're very bullish about the long-term secular growth in internet usage in China. It's the largest internet market in the world. It's the fastest-growing internet market in the world. And it's particularly in a favorable position for e-commerce. E-commerce in the United States is only about 7% of total retail sales, but it's much, much higher in China, and it's expected to go even higher. There is less of a retail culture, if you will, in China, i.e. let's go shopping on Sunday. They don't necessarily have that as much. And as a result, e-commerce has actually grown much faster in China than it has in a lot of the Western markets. So, you know, the Alibaba opportunity there is tremendous. I think U.S. and Western investors recognize that. There are very few ways for Western investors to invest in this growth story. Alibaba will be by far the largest, most liquid, and arguably safest investment vehicle.
Bloomberg's Paul Sweeney in conversation with Judy Woodruff on the PBS NewsHour. Other observers argue that Alibaba, in its own way, is changing China. Juliet Garside covers telecoms and technology for The Guardian newspaper in London and spoke on its Tech Weekly podcast.
These are entrepreneurs who really are the kind of heroes of the post-cultural revolution generation, because they were operating in a sphere that government had limited control and understanding over. And they were able to gain cultural freedoms, but also business freedom as business leaders that people in other spheres didn't have. And so they are not quite countercultural, but they are seen as a strong balance to the government. And I think Jack Ma's saying is that you should love the government. He tells the staff you should love the government but never marry the government. And he's rejected multiple approaches for state ownership.
Juliet Garside of The Guardian. There are many unanswered questions about Alibaba's IPO. Its prospectus provides no current company market value. Analysts say it sheds little light on many of the company's dealings. Indeed, the company says it's not bound by US securities regulations to provide timely, detailed financial statements even after its IPO is launched. The company founded by Jack Ma will now come under more scrutiny than ever before, as investors have to decide whether or not to buy a piece of the Alibaba action. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Monday, genetically modified food labelling becomes a reality in the United States. That's Monday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.